Well, I am very excited this morning, obviously, to host the Economic Forum. We've just enjoyed a great global scene setting and, of course, pivoting back to Australia, the country we all live in. And what better way to do it than with a fireside chat with RBA Deputy Governor Andrew Houser. I'd ask you all just to take a moment to join me in welcoming Andrew and thank him for his time. So I also personally want to thank you. I know how busy your diary is, so to make the time to come and talk to us today is something that we at Barrenjoey truly value. I also know there's lots of people in the room that are looking forward to the opportunity to ask you some Q&A. So we will have some time for audience Q&A, so please make sure that you've got your questions ready. Don't be shy. Before that, of course, it's you and me, and I'm incredibly excited to talk to you. This fireside has come at a really opportune time, as we talked about, sandwiched, of course, between the domestic CPI data yesterday and the end of the tariff pause tomorrow. So maybe CPI is a good place to start, Andrew. We obviously got the quarterly and monthly CPI data yesterday, the June quarter trimming coming in at 2.7%. The bank had already communicated a little bit of upside risk to their last published forecast of 2.6%. There's plenty of investors in the room today. So perhaps can I just ask you any reflections that you have on the data and the outlook?
Well, Joe, thanks very much for the invite, and it's good to be here. The data yesterday were very welcome. I could stop there. But let me just step back a second and remind you of something I know you know. Our strategy for some time has been to set interest rates to bring inflation back sustainably. That's an important word. To the midpoint of the 2-3% target range, and to do that through a policy that is gradual, considered, measured, there's lots of words, predictable, we might come back to that word, in a way with the goal of protecting the gains to employment, which is important and is part of our objective. In the, I would call it Q1, but the March quarter of this year, quarterly trim mean inflation, which, as you know, is our preferred measure of underlying inflation, was 2.9%. That was in the band, but only just. And we said at the time, we cut interest rates twice, 50 basis points at the start of the year, that we were looking for more evidence that inflation was moving sustainably back to the midpoint. And we've had another piece of that jigsaw yesterday. So, as I say, that number is welcome. In fact, you know, 2.7, there or thereabouts, very much as we had expected, as you say, maybe plus or minus a little bit. The quarterly inflation rate in trim mean was actually 0.59, and you know, our team took some pleasure from the fact that their forecast actually at the time of May was 0.59. I think part of my job as sort of one of the older hands is to say, be careful, you won't get that kind of forecast accuracy very much. But I know other people use words outstanding, superb, and so forth. I'll say very welcome, because it's my job to be slightly more boring.
Indeed. It's interesting that suddenly forecasting to two decimal places has become the norm. That wasn't the case at the start of my career.
No, and look, it isn't now either. I'll come back to this maybe later. You can't expect that degree of accuracy. We used to spend years at the Bank of England years ago looking at inflation at 2.01, 1.99. People started getting to the third decimal place. It's luck when you get that close, and we have to remember to be humble in that respect.
Forecasting is a humbling experience. Let's stick with inflation. The governor has consistently reminded us, including last week, that the quarterly trimmed mean measure is really what anchors the Reserve Bank's view. From November, we will have what the ABS is calling a full monthly CPI, 87% coverage on that, globally comparable. There is, of course, though, a transition period. I know not everyone in the room follows CPI quite as closely as perhaps others do, but there is a transition period because 10% of the basket will have difficulty being seasonally adjusted, and that, of course, is very important for trimmed mean. We understand the RBA has requested the ABS to continue to publish the quarterly trim mean under that old methodology. I'm just interested in how is the RBA planning to manage that 18-month transition period with the data?
Well, let's start actually by saying, you know, how much we welcome this monthly measure. I had to adjust, you know, back when I came from the UK to a world in which you only really know where inflation is once a quarter. That's quite challenging when it's your main target variable. So it's fantastic news, and we should give credit to the ABS, David Gruen, for doing that. It's taken some effort and some IT work, and so that's, we're very grateful for that. As you say, we're all going to have to go on a bit of a learning journey. The seasonality of this measure will be something we'll have to get to understand in the first period. Some of the underlying data series have only been gathered since last year. You can't possibly know the seasonal pattern of a series that we don't even have, you know, a couple of years' data for. We usually have a three-year criterion for understanding seasonality. There are other things too. There's a different scope. There's a different mechanism, obviously, for doing the trim mean mechanism on a monthly basis. So yes, we will learn, and we'll do that in part by looking at the monthly trim mean alongside the quarterly trim mean, which, as you know, the ABS will continue to publish for a period. But look, better information, more frequent information is unambiguously good news. And, you know, we have lots of people, as you do too, very adept at crunching those data. We'll probably put some kind of communication out probably in the November SNP that sets out the metrics we'll use and how we'll think about it. But we'll be learning, and I know so will you. In fact, you put out, you told me nobody read your analysis before this, so I'm sure you guys read it closely.
And you asked me how many of our clients actually read our report, so you're all on notice.
But you did a very, I'm sorry, not blowing smoke, but you did a very good and probably more comprehensive piece than I've been able to cover here on this topic. So, yeah, read that.
Thank you for that, Andrew.
Do I get a bonus? I don't know.
Absolutely. You get a muffin on the way out.
All right. That's quite cheap.
unfortunately, you've got to run off, right? So let's move away from inflation. I'd like to pivot a bit to tariffs. Obviously, very topical for Australia. We don't have a trade deal. We're highly exposed through...
Well, we do have a free trade agreement.
We do have a free trade agreement. We don't know really where that lands in the next 24 hours or so. It's been a roller coaster, I think it's fair to say. As Ajay talked about, we're looking at a 15% lift in the average US tariff rate. By any measure, that is a material lift in tariffs, and yet financial markets seem broadly unfazed. You spoke at the Economic Society of Australia conference recently, and you said markets can seemingly shrug and move on. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that, but I did want to ask you, do you think the global economy and Australia can do the same?
There are three, maybe four reasons why, you know, so far maybe the impact is, well, the impact is substantially better than we'd, those of us had feared in the worst case. Sorry, that's a rather convoluted way of putting that simple point. I think there's sort of three broad reasons why that might be. One is that the worst of the threatened tariffs, you know, haven't eventuated. That's not just true, of course, of the US. It's actually particularly true in terms of retaliation. And one of the charts, everyone looks at that chart of US tariffs that's going back to the 30s and goes, oh my gosh, isn't that terrible? And that's a real increase, clearly, if it persists. But if you plot the same chart, and I don't know if you've done this for world tariffs, it's harder to do. The pickup is there, but it's much more modest. It's of the order of a couple of percentage points, we think, estimated. And so if you think about the global impact as opposed to the impact on the US, because of that lack of retaliation, because some of the biggest threats haven't eventuated, you start from the point where, and who knows what tomorrow will bring, or the next day, you start from the place where, you know, the policy decisions have been less severe than they could have been. So that's step one. Step two, which Ajay was talking a lot about, is, well, look, maybe the system globally, and perhaps in Australia too, is more resilient than we first feared. That would obviously be good news. We've seen a lot of stockpiling. We've seen a lot of trade diversion, apparently. That's been fascinating, the speed and scale with which that appears to have occurred. Some of the portfolio shifts that people in the room, I'm sure, still thinking about, you know, haven't yet eventuated. Hedging ratios perhaps have moved a bit, but underlying positions don't seem to have moved as much. AI and all the other things that Ajay was talking about. Let me go to the third reason, I'll come back to the second. The third reason, which is a bit more worrying, and I say this particularly as someone that comes from the UK, is that it's coming, it just hasn't come yet. Why do I say the UK point? Because you may remember when Brexit occurred, everyone rushed to, you know, the exit gate, and nothing happened. But my goodness me, 10 years on, I think it's fair to say things are happening. And so we need to be, I think, a bit careful about doing this. Wow, the global economy is a rubber ball. It's all bounced perfectly back and nothing's happened. If those tariffs stick, there's a real tax increase. Someone has to pay it. There's obviously an interesting question about who. So I think, look, good news that it hasn't been as severe yet as we feared. Good news for Australia as well. But we're paid to worry. And some of that possibility that it's actually a bit more drawn out rather than it's nothing to worry about is certainly on our mind.
Thank you. A key focus of investors and lots of people in the room today is around the neutral rate
for Australia. In fact, you told me you spent more time on that issue than any other.
I did tell you we get a lot of inbound questions. And a lot of that, of course, has come off the downward revision to the median of the RBA's modelled estimates. As economists, we know that the neutral rate is unobservable. But we do see other central banks, like the RBNZ, for example, who do publish estimates of their neutral rate. I'm not going to ask you where Australia's neutral rate is, but I did want to ask you what you think the downside of such a strategy is.
When I was at the Bank of England one day, a junior analyst sent a very sort of genuine email saying, can someone tell me where to find, you know, the neutral rate? He just meant, you know, where on the system. And some wag wrote back and said, yeah, it's in the same place as Nauru and the solution to world peace. That was a bit cruel, but you can't find it on the D drive, let's just put it that way. Let me make two points about this. One, I think, I don't know how interested investors are in some concept called the neutral rate, you know, the rate at which when all shocks have worked through the system, the real rate, not nominal rate, settles. I mean, that's a very conceptual concept, and probably, you know, you're talking about 5 or 10 years, I'm not sure how many people trade at that level and are interested in that. What I sense is that people want to know where interest rates are going. And obviously there's a history to that debate in Australia. There's a history to that debate everywhere. My answer to, if that's the question, which I wouldn't frame as a neutral, is go and look at our forecasts. Because our forecasts, and what we try to do is take account of all of the available information and say, look, what is the outlook for inflation, unemployment, growth, and so forth, conditioned on a particular path for interest rates. And our forecast in May, we're obviously working on a new one now, was that with interest rates following a sort of fairly gradual and gentle path down to about 3.2 at the end of our forecast period, inflation would come back to target. Now, it takes a little bit of intellectual agility to work out what that means, but I would say not very much. And I would gently and humbly encourage people to pay a bit more attention to that forecast than perhaps some people do. We do also publish the famous chart of R-star, which everyone in the room, I'm sure has pored over. I'd start by reminding of one point. The range of estimates on that is 1% to 4%. I have no idea how anyone could trade on the basis of that range. We put a middle point in it as well. Maybe that was a mistake. But what that range is supposed to try and draw out is that the different models that we use in that give you very, very different answers. At best, they're a cross-check to that forecast, but they are not something that drives the policy board's thinking about where interest rates should go. Some people put weight on some of them, some people put weight on none of them. We put a comment in the minutes that I think many people have picked up on, that it was possible in very central banking language, a bit like the welcome thing, it was possible that people have placed a bit more weight on that than they should. And I'd remind people of that. If we added another model into that range tomorrow, and we easily could do so, might be on the upside, might be on the downside, that average would change. It might change by 50 basis points. That wouldn't be a very meaningful indicator for the future of policy. Look at our forecasts, listen to what the governor says at the press conference, read the minutes. Those are the things that will give you insight about our thinking about the outlook for the economy and the appropriate response of policy.
I really appreciate that answer because we're now going to grab the transcript and we're going to use that every time somebody asks us where we think, the RBA think, the neutral rate may be. I want to move to another unobservable concept, which is full employment. Governor Bullock spoke around the labour market last week. I'm interested in exploring, though, the RBA's evolving strategy in the context of the labour market. In particular, I guess the Fed also have a dual mandate, but one interpretation of the way that the Fed run with that is that they have been guided to eliminate shortfalls in full employment rather than minimise any deviation in either direction. In a sense, they worry only when the labour market is worrying, and they don't worry when it's strong. And of course, that's where we are in Australia. The labour market has consistently surprised both the RBA and all economists in a good way over the last year. So I guess my question is, does the RBA think about that labour market concept, in given their dual mandate, in the same way as the Fed?
Let me just start with a brief word on the labour market. Obviously, the governor gave a speech on this last week, and anyone hasn't read it, I'd recommend them to. There was quite a lot of excitement about the unemployment number that came out. I just want to re-underscore the point that she made in that speech, which is that those numbers were in line with our forecast. In fact, on a quarterly average, they were bang in line with the forecast. And they were consistent, too, with the broad coming into balance in the economy that we need to see for monetary policy to work. As you say, there's a lively debate about exactly how tight the market is. And we have that debate on the board and we have it outside the board. And I think that's a good thing. There are different views on the board about exactly how tight the labour market is. But on any measure, unemployment is historically still very low. And I spent quite a bit of time going out around Australia, speaking to firms to get a sense of their economic conditions. And it's quite clear that it's easier than it was to find the right member of staff, but you're paying the going rate for it, and the search process takes time. So whether you call that tight or full or whatever you might call it, this is a labour market that is, you know, close to whatever full employment means, and we can debate about exactly whether it's above or below and how far below. On your question about strategy, and you and I had a bit of an exchange about this, the Fed, as you say, introduced a new framework in 2020-2021, which some people call FAIT, Flexible Average Inflation Targeting. It had two features that were designed to try and create a kind of asymmetry. One was that if you had a period of undershooting of inflation, you could tolerate a period of over-target inflation. And the other one was, as you say, this quite subtle edit, which says that the committee should have should take account of shortfalls of employment from full employment, which people read to mean, okay, if it's above full employment, that shouldn't be relevant to policy. The challenge for the Fed, and I don't wish to chuck any other central bank under a bus, is at the moment they introduced this asymmetry, which is designed to get them out of the zero lower bound situation. Inflation went to the moon, and many of those components of the framework were either switched off effectively or formally, and are now the subject of the review that Jay Powell has said he wants to try and get done before he leaves office next year. So I don't know that that framework is particularly active, that element of the framework, sorry, in the US. And to be frank, it isn't part of the framework here. We take account of all macroeconomic drivers when we think about inflation, and we certainly take account of where we think the labour market is. And look, let's not forget the enormous gains in employment that have occurred over the past 2 or 3 years. That's part of the RBA's remit, and it's a very welcome, you know, result of a lot of different policies, not just monetary policy, but monetary policy has played its role in delivering what I think by most measures you have to say is close to full employment.
Thanks for that. Talking about reviews, obviously you've joined the RBA at a time post their own review. Some very material changes occurring and still occurring, yeah. Really. You also spent many years at the Bank of England, of course, and that international perspective is one of the reasons why you're sitting here today, and one of the reasons that we really value from you, Andrew. One of the most recent elements or changes, of course, has been the decision to publish unattributed votes, yeah, and encourage public addresses by board members. Yeah. For financial market people, everyone's very excited by these unattributed votes, as you can imagine. People are starting to put charts together on dovish and hawkish and the like. I guess I wanted to ask you, given that global experience, that experience in the Bank of England. What are your observations on the evolving process of the RBA, which has a number of elements behind it?
I mean, look, I don't. It's point number one is, of course, I don't have a baseline. I actually have had many contacts with the RBA over the years and very positive ones, but I don't have a baseline for where the policy process was some years ago. So I should make that very important point. I'd say there are three elements of the setup here that appear quite different between the UK and Australia, but I think when you delve behind them, they're actually far less different than you might think. The first is, in the UK, obviously, the MPC consists largely of professional economists, not entirely, but mainly, and in the RBA, it's a broader set of people. I think the setup here has many merits, let me put it that way. You get a bunch of economists in a room, and I'm sure they have great insight, but they also love to debate about things that are not always first order important. My model's better than your model, there's some egos going, et cetera, et cetera, so hopefully this doesn't get back to the UK. Obviously there are other benefits, but there's that, and I think we have less of that. I think what we also have, and it's very much, each system has to be designed for the country in which it's working, is we do have a breadth of perspective. And if you think about it, and I could run through, we have a couple of academics. We have a couple of people who are on the boards of large companies. We have Marnie, who's just joined, who obviously has experience of running a bank and is very passionate about regional Australia. We have Ian Ross, who understands about wage setting and labour markets. That's a really rich set of experience, and again, I don't have a baseline, and I know there are different views about this, but this is a pretty active debate that occurs on that board, and that's a good thing. Yes. The vote, in a way, just throws light on that, and I think it's obviously interesting, and kept us awake a bit. The very first time we disclosed, votes, we also had a split vote. But I think, in a way, and given, there's obviously some chatter, and I might even get a question about it, around that particular decision, showing that the board had a range of views about that outcome, I think probably helped. I hope it helped you understand that it wasn't a sort of monolithic, there's only one view, my way or the highway. That's not how it works on the board. We don't name names. We're told not to, and we will choose not to, and that's to keep the focus on the arguments. And that's something that the whole board is very, very passionate about. In our judgment, and the judgment of those who wrote the statement on the conduct of monetary policy, it's more likely to lead to a more open debate on the board and externally if you take the names and the personalities out of it. I watch it on those hawkish measures, by the way. I know Millennium's here, but I used to not, other hedge funds are available, but some hedge funds used to spend a lot of time modelling what they thought the individual reaction functions of individual MPC members were. It's a mug's game. I actually know some of these people personally, and there's no rule that would describe how they behave. So I think that probably is a bit of a red herring. I know it's exciting, but it probably wouldn't give you deeper insight on that. There is one other component that's different, and that's that in the MPC, the committee owns their own forecasts, whereas in the RBA, it's the staff forecast. The RBA staff are fantastic, and the forecast is excellent. One of the merits of the UK approach is that owning a forecast means you're forced to think ahead. Policy has to be forward-looking. Of course, it has to be forward-looking anyway. It also provides a framework in which people can hone in on the areas of the economy where they have a strongest disagreement and think about the interaction between policy and the outlook for the economy. Those are all quite nice features, in my view, of a close ownership arrangement between the forecast and the board. And it's something for us to reflect on, I think, how we make sure that we get those kinds of ownership things in the future.
I appreciate your candor with that answer. And I agree with you. I actually think the split vote was comforting, given most economists, whilst they perhaps had forecast a cut, most economists were saying it's a very, very close call and it's a probability game. And I think that split vote is a reflection of where the economy is. It's a complex time. Yeah. Now, talking of time, I am conscious of time, and I did promise to keep some time for audience Q&A. So I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll go to the audience. I just wanted to bring it back, actually, to the economy and the cycle. We've talked about the labour market. We've talked about inflation. I wanted to talk a little bit about the consumer, the largest part of the economy, and I think it's fair to say household spending is underwhelmed in the first half of this year. Jono is always telling me All the things that support higher household spending are in place. Real disposable income's rising, house prices are rising. We've had interest rate cuts, tax cuts, and the labour market is still tight. And yet it looks not terrible, but a little mundane given all of that. And I guess I'm keen to just understand how you're seeing the consumer at the moment.
Yeah, it's a good, it's an important question for all the reasons you say. We have seen some recovery in consumers' growth. Let's start there. And we do expect to see more. Our forecasts, like I suspect yours and others, have persistently undershot for the reasons you describe. And that's despite taking account of income and wealth, the effect of interest rates and the effect of tax changes. So, you know, people will obviously legitimately say, well, of course, it hasn't been very strong because you've had tight policy or X, Y, and Z. We have tried to take account of those things, and there's still an unexplained element, as you rightly say. A clue is clearly in consumer confidence. Consumer confidence here is pretty weak. That's not unique to Australia. It's a pretty common feature of most developed economies, and it hasn't picked up very much as the economy has started to recover. Hasn't got worse. I think we put some weight on that. It hasn't got worse as the, you know, the global uncertainty has improved, but it has got worse. But it hasn't got better either. Why is that? Because, as you know, if you plot consumer confidence against what's rather regrettably called the misery index over time, which is unemployment plus inflation, it's pretty close. People don't like being out of work, and people don't like high inflation. Unemployment is low, and inflation is coming back down to target. You might expect, and I think many people have, that consumer confidence will recover, and it hasn't done so. Now, I think if you put that question to a person on the street, they say, oh, you economists, what a ridiculous thing. You're worrying why we're depressed, right? Real incomes have been very weak. The price level is, what, 20%, 15, 20% higher than it was 3 years ago. Every time I go to the shops, I'm reminded of that fact. You know, go and check your head. I mean, there's something wrong with you if you can't understand why we're, you know, consumer confidence is weak. And you know, you might call that scarring effects of past weak real income growth or whatever you want to call it, but it is a fact. I don't know if you tried to do this, but it's actually quite hard to model this effect in any very effective way. You try and put price levels in, you try and put past real income growth. We had a lot of clever people work on this. You can't get a stable model. So there's something special happening this time relative to the past. There are reasons for optimism for the future, one of which is obviously that real income growth really has begun to grow quite strongly now, 1.7 in the first quarter, for example, of this year, the March quarter, I should say. Savings ratio is back to its pre-COVID average now, having been quite persistently belowing. We are beginning to see, well, there's some slightly countervailing evidence of this, isn't there, in the US and the latest data, but we are beginning to see in some countries a pickup in consumption growth as well. So maybe this time the consumption pickup that I'm sure you have too will prove to be true. But this is one of the areas of debate on the board, to be honest. How much momentum is there in the economy? And for some of those who don't think rates should be quite as high, they would say that they have downside risks, worries about this, that maybe consumer confidence will persist at a very weak level. Maybe people will wake up to what's going on in the global economy and become more concerned about future employment prospects and so forth. So I think on balance, I mean, we haven't finished our forecast yet, but I think on balance we're obviously going to continue to hope and pray and forecast that consumption growth will pick up. But like you, we are struggling to understand the full reasons for that driver.
Glad we're not alone in that. We do, as you said, Andrew, in our forecast have a pickup in consumption, and some of that does require households to start to draw down on some of their savings rate. And we did just run and publish a bit of a thought experiment of what happens if that doesn't happen through into inflation and GDP and the output gap.
I mean, obviously, if incomes keep recovering and consumption does pick up, you're going to get a very substantial pickup in savings. Mm. Now, that may be where people choose to be. But that will, I mean, that, you know, it's obviously, I'm sure you did, but it's worth working through what the economic consequences of that are as well.
So we can share that with our clients in the room. So I'm going to open up to questions from the audience. Again, if I could just ask you to share your name and organisation. And I saw Kath already ready to roll.
So
over to you, Kath.
Thanks, Jo. Catherine Orfrey from Wavestone Capital. I'm an equity investor, so I spend a lot of time talking to corporates.
Yeah.
You'll be pleased to know, though, after six weeks ago, I went to New Zealand and I saw what bad looked like in terms of central bank policy and the impact it has on the economy. And I actually then became a fan of the IBA in terms of what's done.
Only then?
Yeah, exactly. Only then.
I won't ask your age. That's pretty recent, if I may say so.
But what the corporates keep worrying about, and that you haven't actually talked about the crowding out of the private sector over the last few years, right. They keep worrying about the Victorianisation of the Australian economy, right? And the policies that Victoria has implemented, against business, so to speak, and the worry that they have that that's going to spread up the East Coast. But I guess my question to you is, because we've got the Productivity Roundtable coming up, what would the RBA like to see from it? Because the one thing that corporates obviously can see a shining light, and we heard it from AJ this morning, is that AI is obviously something that they can sort of hang their hat on in terms of getting some cost savings and expansion in their margins. So what is the RBA looking for in terms of out of that Productivity Roundtable?
Well, look, let's be clear. I mean, AJ was talking about being at Laws. You're going to see some quite boring cricket shots here, I think. I mean, let's be clear. Policy towards IR or whatever you might want to call it. Victorianisation, by the way, to a UK person means something quite different to what I think it would mean to you. Although maybe sort of in a way it's the same concept. But those policies aren't for us. We take the economy as it is and we deliver our mandate, which is low and stable inflation and full employment. And, those are political choices. They're choices that are based on the democratic process. And any central bank that gets into that space, frankly, takes risks with its own credibility and ultimately probably, undermines the economy rather than improves it. So I'm sorry for that bit of theology, but I think it is important. It's for others to deal with, and we take the outputs from that. It obviously is the case, as you say, that productivity growth in Australia and in most other developed economies, with the notable exception of the US, has been very weak. Level of productivity roughly the same as where it was 10 years ago. That's a screaming siren for all of us, and something that we need to focus on, and it is very good, therefore, that we are focusing on that. The level of productivity growth in some sense sets the speed limit for the economy, and that it therefore means the weaker economic growth, the slower we can keep demand growing in order to hit the inflation target. And actually, coming back to the consumption debate, one of the very interesting questions will obviously be, well, look, suppose productivity remains weak, consumption doesn't pick up very much, people will say, oh, that must be because policy is too tight. Well, it may very well not be. It may well actually just be, well, that's the speed rate of the economy. It's lower than we would wish it was. It's lower than it has been in the past. We shouldn't be loosening rates. The need to speed that economy up lies with other people. I make one other point, and it links to one I already made. Australia's not alone in this. And I think what is quite interesting, there's a similar debate going on in the UK where growth has been, really absent. You might say it's because of Brexit or some other completely. Every country thinks, oh, the reason for our weak productivity must be very local concerns. And frankly, that's what's happening in Australia as well. And maybe it is. Or maybe, in fact, the cross-cutting themes, you talk about technology, AI, competition, these rather broader and macroeconomic concepts are more important than some of the individual policy choices, which I say are politically driven rather than anything else. So I think the roundtable, I mean, it'll be fascinating, to be honest. You'll know it's public knowledge that the governor will speak at the first day, mainly just to set out the high-level challenges of the kind we've already talked about, but it will be fascinating to see what comes out of that process. It's well-timed. Australia's had a fantastic productivity story over the longer run. I've talked about this before. I was just up in the Pilbara last week. You wanted to go and see productivity. My God, you go up there and look at the scale and the efficiency and the sheer impressiveness of that operation. But most of that is productivity level, not productivity growth. It's a mature business. Where that next wave of growth is coming from for you, particularly as an equity investor, I'm sure if you can get in there ahead of time, you'd be very welcome. It's a crucial question for the economy and one that we all wait the answers to with great interest.
And I might just remind, the governor mentioned last week that the next SOMP will include some information around the bank's work on productivity and their underlying assumptions to that. Any other questions? Oh, gosh, sure.
Good morning. Daniel Park from Westpac Treasury. Thank you for your time today. I wanted to ask you a question around protecting the gains of employment, which you sort of started out on. So RBA has been very good at forecasting the rise in unemployment to 4.3%, but it's sort of got 4.3 as the unemployment rate now, as far as the eye can see.
That's the most recent forecast.
The most recent forecast that we can look at. if we're feeling more confident on inflation, how should we think about the evolution of unemployment from here? If it was to continue to rise, is that moving away from protecting the gains of unemployment, or is that sort of something that can be continuously updated in forecast, I guess?
Look, I mean, you were going to ask me a question. Sorry, it's not that we arranged this in advance. But you were going to ask me a question about what my favourite chart was.
I was.
So let me start there, because you didn't ask it. I prepared it. I'm not giving that away for nothing. So one of my favourite charts is the Israel Borer, one you probably just flick through when you look at the, if you look at it at all, the same in monetary policy, which is the cones of uncertainty around these individual variables. And we talked about 0.59% on quarterly inflation, you know, 4.3% on unemployment. That cone around unemployment, which is simply based on our past forecast errors for unemployment, is really wide. Right, and 4.2, 4.1, 4.3, they're great outcomes, but they're within such a tiny range relative to past experience. So we could easily get surprised by unemployment or other macroeconomic variables on either side, and we'd obviously, you know, have to react. If you think, and I don't know how much, you know, forecasting you do yourself in your job, I mean, if you think that the economy is relatively close to balance, then our job, and this isn't going to be easy, it's a bit like I was once shown how a helicopter pilot works with having to keep this thing perfectly in equilibrium, is to keep the economy close to that balance. And, you know, inflation close to the midpoint, full employment close to full employment, and react to shocks either side of that as we see. That won't be an easy thing to pull off. I'm not sure many central banks in the past have pulled it off, and I'm not going to claim we will manage to do so. But obviously, if unemployment did rise sharply, and it's within that bound of my favourite chart, we'd have to react. Sorry, I know that's not a very full and complete answer to your question. It's not been our central case in our forecast, but it's clearly a possible outcome.
Well, we'll be looking at that chart, Andrew. I'm glad you've got a favourite chart. I think all economists have one secretly.
Yeah.
We've got time for one more question. Michael.
Thanks, Jo. Michael Yander from the ABC. Just a question about those speeches from individual board members that are going to be taking place. Will those board members be able to speak as individuals and give their own opinions on the direction of monetary policy and the economy? Or are the speeches going to be a reflection of the board's collective view at a given point in time and vetted by RBA staff?
Well, okay, a very directional question. The we're still working that out, I'll be totally honest with you. The idea of the public engagement approach is a broad one. So you bring it down to speeches. I mean, our head of comms, we've got David Bold here, you know, will often say to us, speeches are a thing of the past. We need to engage more like this and in podcasts and other things. So that's a rather superficial point, but I just make the point that whether these things amount to speeches, theological, you know, edicts from on high, we'll see, because we're trying to move our communication approach forward a bit. It's also about listening. So it's also about getting out to public events and hearing from communities and businesses and how the economy is operating as well. So I just want to make that point that the definition of public engagement under the SCMP and in our own minds is broader than just these sort of edicts from individual members. It will be important when individual members speak, just as it is when I speak and the governor speaks, that we don't identify the views of other individuals or indeed of ourselves. So the challenge, as I think you rightly say, will be to ensure that we do throw light onto the range of debates in the economy without breaching that important principle. It is an important principle. I think you will find that the quality of debate internally, and I fear externally too, sorry, whatever you'd like it for. I think you'd like it for a day, for a week, and I think you'd then hate the petty behaviour that occurred when individuals felt that they had to defend their own positions. And actually, if I'm totally honest, that's what's happened in the UK. Certain individuals begin to feel that they have to explain themselves at every minute of every day, and Joe Masters, the equivalent in the UK, needs to know exactly what I think. No, you don't. You know full well what that person thinks, and by the way, they're not influencing the centre of the debate. So be careful, I would say, on wishing that a kind of, you know, it's a 24-hour joy followed by a great deal of regret after a hangover four or something, I don't know. But it will be important to tread that line, as you say. There's no point in individual members of the board speaking if all they do is parrot, you know, this is what we agreed and then let's finish. We have to throw light on the debate in the board, but we have to do it in a way that respects that rule, that has been, you know, agreed with the Treasury, it's not just our self-imposed rule, and ensures that the quality of that internal debate continues. So we'll have to get that right, and it will be tricky, but I hope all of you, including the ABC, you know, will report it in the general sense of wanting to get a deeper understanding about how policy is seen, the outlook, and where it's going. And I do genuinely believe, by the way, I'm a big believer in this vote disclosure, I do genuinely believe it will be to lead to a more grown-up and better debate, but we will have to feel our way a bit. And if there are some mistakes along the way, I'm sure there will be. We'll have to work out how we deal with them.
Yeah, well, hopefully you're operating in a world of grown-ups. Now, John's been very patiently waiting, so over to you, John.
Thanks, Joan. Thanks, Andrew, for the speech.
It wasn't the speech, that's right. You see.
It's John Keogh from the Australian Financial Review. I wanted to ask you about the central bank's communication. You mentioned just in passing the importance of predictability. There has been some criticisms about the bank's communication, particularly the market being caught unaware about the no interest rate change in July. There's also a school of thought there amongst some season watchers that you as the deputy need to be getting out there more and talking and communicating about what the bank's view is on the economy, given that Michelle is a bit constrained because she's doing 8 press conferences a year. She's only doing 2 or 3 speeches as a result of that. What would you say to those criticisms?
So on the first point, and you're talking about July, I'd make a couple of points. I'd say that policy, you know, ought to have 2 goals. We should be trying to set policy right, and we should be trying to set policy in a way that is predictable. And on the whole, those two should overlap. And if I, before we go to July, I just go back to, and I've only been here 18 months, but I go back to the past 18 months, and I'd say, look, if you look on average at how market pricing has responded to data, which I think is the best test of whether people genuinely understand where the RBA is going, on the whole, John, I'd say those market reactions were broadly, you know, in a sensible place. And I think we took some comfort, and I think others in the market did too, that there was a pretty decent level of understanding about where the RBA was going. And so for the vast majority of occasions, those 2 goals of hopefully getting it right, I'd say hopefully, and being predictable, have actually been highly overlapping. So let's not declare this to be some sort of catastrophe, because, and I know you're not, but before it is. There were some very specific challenges in, actually it dates back to May, right, rather than July, and we talked about it at the beginning, AJ talked about it too, where there was a dramatic series of a set of information about a change to the what you might call the rules of the global economy, and we, alongside others, you know, put a whole range of scenarios out about how this might play out, including some very negative ones. And it is true that in May in particular, the board discussed, well, what if it's really 145% on China? What if everyone in the EU reciprocates and the global trade war breaks out? And, you know, fairly quickly, to be candid, the discussion was, well, look, we've got room to move policy, and we would move policy. That was something of an innovation for us, and we'll keep refining how we sort of do that. But obviously, whenever you do scenarios like that, people are thinking, oh, what probability are they putting on this? Wow, if they've actually gone to the extent of putting this out in public, they must be thinking this is really quite a likely outcome. We didn't think it was a likely outcome. The governor said at the press conference it wasn't a likely outcome, that the discussion around 50 didn't take very much time. And, you know, maybe the market formed a view that actually it was a more likely outcome after May than it was. We actually look back, John, it's rare, but when the RBA has surprised the market to that extent before, there's only a handful of occasions. They almost all happened in the context of very large global events, when everyone was scrambling to work out which part of the probability distribution are we actually on. Wow, maybe the RBA is going to do this, maybe the RBA is going to do that. And of course, the honest truth is that everyone was learning how to think about that large shock at the same time. I think that's quite instructive. We wouldn't expect this overlap between doing the right thing by the data and doing the predictable thing to be, you know, as weak as perhaps it was in July. Me getting out more, I mean, I could be available 24/7 if you like. It's slightly ironic that you're making that point in a place where I'm actually...
Andrew, we'll welcome you anytime.
All right, okay. Look, I'm a bit... In the UK TV, if this happened, you'd put someone would come up and put tape across the name. So I'm sure this will help you no end. But I'm very happy to get out and about and describe ourselves. I actually do quite a bit. I suspect the statistics would show that I have been out and about quite a bit. As I say, I'm not just doing it in Sydney and Melbourne. I'm out in the regions and far-flung bits of Australia doing it as well. Very happy to do more of it. I would encourage, you know, to some extent, you know, this idea that if you just listen carefully enough, you'll get the truth is slightly misleading. I know you're not saying that, but I'll put it there for effect. To some extent, what we're going to tell you is, look, we're uncertain. We're feeling our way. It's a board decision, not an individual decision. So the irreducible uncertainty of policymaking is something I think we're all getting a little bit more comfortable with, and there will be shocks from time to time. But I don't expect, John, that you will see a whole sequence of us hopefully doing the right thing, but the unpredictable thing. Again, it will happen from time to time. It's not our norm.
And I think that's a great place to wrap it up. Personally from me, Andrew, thank you so much again for making the time and for your candor today. It is always a delight for me to chat to you. And if everyone could just help me, to thank Andrew for his time and candor today.
Thank you.